On the embassy to Gaius. How long shall we old men still be children, our bodies gray with the length of time, but our souls, through sheer lack of perception, utter infants? We think fortune, the most unsteady of things, is the most fixed, and nature, the most stable of things, the least secure. We keep changing our judgments, as in a game of checkers shifting our pieces, supposing that the products of chance are more lasting than the products of nature, and that what accords with nature is less secure than the products of chance. The cause is that we judge present things without foresight of what is to come, using a perception that wanders in place of an understanding that does not wander. For the eye grasps what is in plain view and within reach, but reason presses on even to what is unseen and future, reason whose sight is keener than that of the body's eyes, yet we dim it, some by drunkenness and by gorging themselves, others by the greatest of evils, ignorance. Still, the present occasion, and the many great matters judged in connection with it, are enough to persuade those, even if some have become unbelieving, that the divine takes forethought for human beings, and especially for the suppliant race, which has been allotted to the Father and King of the universe, the cause of all things. This race is called, in Chaldean, Israel, and when the name is translated into Greek, it means the one who sees God, which to my mind is the most precious of all possessions, private or common. For if the sight of elders, or teachers, or rulers, or parents moves those who behold them to reverence and good order and zeal for a life of self-control, how much greater a foundation of virtue and nobility of character do we suppose will be found in souls that have been trained, bending beneath everything that has come into being, to see the uncreated and divine. The first good, beautiful, blessed, and happy, or rather, if the truth must be told, that which is better than the good. More beautiful than the beautiful, more blessed than blessedness itself, and happier than happiness itself, and more perfect than anything that has been said. For reason cannot climb up to the God who is untouchable and altogether intangible, but falls back and recedes, unable to use even his own proper names as a stepping stone toward disclosure. I do not mean a name for his being, since not even the whole heaven, were it to become an articulate voice, could ever find words apt and well aimed enough for that, but names for the powers that attend him as his bodyguard. The power that makes the world, the royal power, the power of providence and the others, as many as are beneficent and as many as are punitive, even if the punitive powers should be reckoned among the beneficent, not only because they form a part of laws and ordinances, for law is by nature completed out of two things, honor for the good and punishment for the wicked, but also because punishment itself often admonishes and disciplines even those who have sinned, and if not them, then certainly those near them. For the punishments of others improve the many, through fear of suffering the like. For who, seeing Gaius, after the death of Tiberius Caesar, having taken over the government of every land and sea free of faction, well-governed, and fitted together in every part into conquered, eastern, western, southern, northern. The barbarian race in harmony with the Greek with the barbarian, the military with the civic population, the civic population with the soldiery, all agreeing to share and enjoy peace. Who did not marvel and stand amazed at a state of good fortune beyond nature and beyond all account, one who had inherited outright, all at once and in heaps, ready-made goods. Vast treasuries of money, silver, and gold, the one as raw material, the other as coin, the other as adornment fashioned into cups and other things wrought for display. Vast forces, infantry, cavalry, naval. Revenues supplied as though from springs in an ever-flowing stream, a rule over not merely the greater and most necessary parts of the inhabited world, which one might properly call the inhabited world, bounded by two rivers, the Euphrates and the Rhine, the one cutting off Germany and the more savage nations, the Euphrates cutting off Parthia and the tribes of the Sarmatians and Scythians, which are no less wild than the Germanic peoples. But, as I have already said, a rule over everything from where the sun rises to where it sets, both the sea within the ocean and the sea beyond it, over which the Roman people rejoiced, and all Italy, and the nations of Asia and of Europe. For as no one had ever marveled at any emperor there had ever been, all were amazed at him, not hoping to have possession and use of goods both private and common, but thinking they already possessed the fullness of some good fortune, with even greater happiness in store. One could see nothing else throughout the cities but altars, sacrificial victims, sacrifices, people dressed in white, wearing garlands radiant, their faces bright with goodwill shining out from cheerful looks. Festivals, public assemblies, musical contests, horse races, revels, all-night festivities with flutes and lyres. Delights, relaxations, holidays, every kind of pleasure through every sense. Then the rich did not surpass the poor, nor the honored the dishonored, nor creditors their debtors, nor masters their slaves, since the occasion granted equality before the law, so that the life under Cronus, recorded by the poets, was no longer thought a fiction of myth. Because of the abundance and the good season, the freedom from grief and fear, and the rejoicings, shared by whole households together and by whole peoples, by day and by night, which continued unceasing and unbroken for the first 7 months. But in the 8th month, a severe illness fell upon Gaius, who had shortly before, while Tiberius still lived, changed the easier and therefore healthier regimen he had followed into one of extravagance. For much unmixed wine, gluttonous feasting, insatiable appetites even on top of a full belly, ill-timed hot baths, vomiting followed at once again by wine binges and further bouts of gluttony, and lust indulged through boys and women, and whatever else destroys the soul and the body and the bonds that hold each together, all conspired together against him. And the wages of self-control are health and strength, but the wages of lack of self-control are weakness and sickness bordering on death. So when the report spread that he was ill, while the seas were still navigable, for it was the beginning of autumn, the last voyage for seafarers, as they returned from markets everywhere to their own harbors and anchorages, especially those who took care not to winter abroad, people set aside their soft, luxurious life and grew gloomy. Every household and every city became full of anxiety and dejection, as the joy of a little before now hung evenly balanced against a matching grief. For every part of the inhabited world fell sick along with him, suffering a heavier illness than the one that gripped Gaius. For his was an illness of the body alone, but theirs was an illness affecting everyone everywhere. Of strength of soul, of peace, of hopes, of the sharing and enjoyment of good things. For they called to mind how many and how great are the evils that spring from lack of government. Famine, war, the felling of trees, the ravaging of lands, the loss of property, deportations, the incurable fears surrounding slavery and death, for which there was no physician, since they had but one cure, that Gaius regain his strength. So when the illness began to abate, in a short time, even those at the ends of the earth perceived it, for nothing is swifter than a rumor. And every city was in suspense, ever thirsting for better news, until through those arriving the complete recovery was announced as good news. Because of which they turned again from the beginning to the same rejoicings, each continent and every island alike counting his safety as their own. For no one recalls so great a joy having come upon a single country or a single nation at the safety and restoration of a ruler as came, at Gaius, upon the whole inhabited world, both when he took over the government and when he recovered his strength from his illness. For, as though only now beginning to change from a nomadic and beast-like life to one lived together in common and shared, and from desolate wilderness and folds and foothills to settling in walled cities, and from an unsupervised existence to being placed under the charge of some herdsman and leader of the flock over the gentler herd, they rejoiced in their ignorance of the truth. For the human mind is blind when it comes to true perception of what is beneficial, able to use guesswork and conjecture rather than knowledge. So indeed, without delay, he who had been thought a savior and benefactor, and one who would pour down for Asia and Europe new springs of good things for an unshakable happiness, both for each individually and for all in common, as the saying goes, from the very altar, began to change into savagery, or rather revealed the wildness he had been screening beneath the mask of pretense. For his cousin, who had been left as partner in the rule and was more properly his heir, the one was a grandson by adoption, the other by nature Tiberius's own, he put to death, alleging a plot, though not even his age admitted of such a charge. For the poor boy was only just passing from childhood into adolescence. And, as some say, if Tiberius had lived only a short time longer, Gaius would have been removed from the way, since he had proceeded to incurable suspicions, and the legitimate grandson alone would have been declared ruler and heir of his grandfather's rule. But Tiberius was overtaken by fate before he could bring his plans to completion. And Gaius, by outmaneuvering him, expected to escape the charge arising from his transgression of what was due to his partner in rule. The trick was this. Gathering the men in office, he said, "I wish my cousin by birth, but my brother in affection, following also the judgment of the late Tiberius, to share the supreme power with him. And you yourselves see that he is still quite an infant, and in need of guardians, teachers, and tutors. For what greater good could there be than that so great a weight of empire should be laid, not upon a single soul or a single body, but that there should be one able to lighten and share the load with me? As for me," he said, "having outstripped guardians, teachers, and tutors of that age, though still a boy, I already write myself as father, and him as son." With these words, he deceived both those present and the youth himself, for the position given him was bait, since no rule was really hoped for by it, but rather the stripping away of what he already held, and against his co-heir and partner in right he plotted with great confidence, having taken thought for no one. For under Roman law, full authority over a son rests with the father, quite apart from the fact that the imperial office answers to no one, no one daring or able to demand an account of anything whatsoever done. This man, then, having taken him for a mere reserve contestant set aside in the games, he wrestled down, taking pity neither on their having been reared together, nor on their kinship, nor on his youth, that wretched, untimely doomed partner in rule and co-heir, once hoped to be sole emperor because of his very close kinship to Tiberius. For grandsons, when their fathers have died, are counted among their grandfathers in the rank of sons. It is said, too, that when he was ordered to kill himself with his own hand, with a centurion and a tribune standing over him, who had been told not to touch the pollution themselves, on the ground that it was not lawful for the descendants of emperors to be destroyed by others. For he made mention of laws in the midst of lawlessness, and of piety in the midst of impious deeds, mocking the very nature of truth, being wholly without experience. For he had never even seen another man being killed. Nor had he been trained in arms, which are the practice and preliminary exercises of children being reared for empire, on account of wars that may arise. At first, he begged those who had come, stretching out his neck, to kill him. But when they would not consent, he himself took up the sword and asked, out of ignorance and inexperience, where the most fatal spot was, so that with a well-aimed blow he might break off his wretched life. And they, like teachers of misfortune, instructed and pointed out the place where the sword must strike. And he, having received his first and last lesson, became, under compulsion, the murderer of himself, wretched man. When this first and greatest contest had been won by Gaius against Gaius, with no partner left in the rule any longer toward whom those who wished him ill and lived under suspicion might incline, he set himself at once toward a second contest. That against Macro, a man who had striven together with him in everything concerning the government, not only after he had been declared emperor, for it is the mark of flattery to court good fortune, but even earlier, toward his obtaining the rule at all. For Tiberius, using deep intelligence, and being the most skilled of his contemporaries at discerning a man's unspoken intention, and excelling in understanding to the same degree that he excelled in good fortune, often eyed Gaius askance, as one ill-disposed toward the whole house of the Claudii, and attached only to his mother's family. And he feared for his grandson, lest, left young, he should come to ruin, and as one ill-suited toward so great a rule besides. Both because of the unsociable and uncommunicative character of his nature, and because of the unevenness of his ways. For his behavior appeared to Tiberius strange and frenzied, no consistency being preserved either in words or in deeds. Macro, with all his strength, so far as the occasion allowed, courted Tiberius's favor, healing his suspicions, and above all where his mind seemed most deeply wounded, on account of his unceasing fear for his grandson. For he declared that Gaius was well-disposed and obedient, and utterly devoted to his cousin, so much so that out of affection he alone would be willing to yield the rule to him, but that his modesty was of no advantage to him with many, on whose account Gaius, though simple, was thought devious. And whenever a recital of probabilities failed to persuade, he would bring forward the pledge founded on their agreements, saying, "I give my guarantee, I am trustworthy enough for this. I have given sufficient proof of my particular devotion both to Caesar and to Tiberius, having been entrusted with the attack on and overthrow of Sejanus. and in general, he was capable in his praises of Gaius. If one may rightly call praises what were really defenses against charges and accusations that arose from suspicion, obscure and unclear. For, in sum, whatever praises one might utter concerning brothers or legitimate sons, so many and even more did Macro deliver to Tiberius on behalf of Gaius. The cause, as the common report has it, was not only that Macro was courted in return by him, Macro who held the greatest, indeed almost the whole, power in the government, but also that Macro's wife, for a reason left unspoken, day by day anointed and roused her husband to relax nothing of his zeal and assistance on the young man's behalf. It is a terrible thing for a woman to unsettle and lead astray a man's judgment, and above all a lewd woman, for on account of shared complicity, she becomes the more flattering. He, not knowing of the corruption of his marriage and household, and thinking the flattery to be the purest goodwill, was deceived, and without realizing it, through their stratagems admitted his bitterest enemies as though they were his dearest friends. Knowing, then, that he had saved him from destruction when he had come within a hair's breadth of ruin countless times, he used admonitions that were unfeigned and spoken with full frankness. For he wished, like a good craftsman, that his own work should remain undestroyed, dissolved neither by himself nor by another. So whenever he saw him fallen asleep at a banquet, he would rouse him, aiming both at propriety and at safety. For one asleep is easily plotted against, or if he saw him watching dancers with wild excess, or at times dancing along with them, or at the mimes not smiling at shameful jests and jibes with becoming restraint but guffawing more like a boy, or being overcome by the melody of lyre singers or choruses, at times even singing along, he would nudge him, sitting or reclining nearby, and try to restrain him. Often, too, leaning close to his ear, so that no one else might overhear, he would admonish him quietly and gently, saying, "You must not be like anyone present, nor indeed like other men, either in what you watch, or what you hear, or in anything else that comes through the senses, but must excel in every concern of life to the same degree that you surpass others in good fortune. For it is absurd that the ruler of land and sea should be overcome by a song, a dance, a mocking jest, or anything of the kind, rather than always and everywhere remembering his rule, like a shepherd and overseer of a flock, drawing toward his own improvement whatever word or deed comes from anyone at all." Then he would say, "Whenever you happen to be present at theatrical, athletic, or equestrian contests, do not look at the pursuits themselves, but at the excellence achieved within those pursuits, and reason as follows. If, in matters that benefit human life not at all, providing spectators nothing but delight and pleasure, some men labor so hard as to be praised and admired, and to receive prizes and honors and crowns along with public proclamations, what must the man do who possesses the highest and greatest of all arts? The greatest and best of all arts is rulership, through which all good and fertile land, both plain and mountain, is cultivated, and every sea is sailed without danger by cargo ships, in exchange for the goods that lands, out of desire for community, send back and forth to one another, receiving what they lack and sending back the surplus of what they carry. For envy has never mastered the whole inhabited world, nor even its great divisions, all Europe or all Asia. Rather, like a venomous creeping thing, it lurks, having crept into small places against a single man or a single household, or, if ever it should breathe too strongly, against a single city. But it does not approach a wider circle of nation or land, and especially not since your own family, the Augustan house, truly began to preside over all things everywhere. For whatever harmful things flourished and were found in our midst, he drove into exile beyond the borders and into the recesses of Tartarus, while things beneficial and profitable, which had in some sense been banished, he brought back from the ends of earth and sea into our own inhabited world, all of which are entrusted to be steered by your single hand. Escorted by nature to the very highest stern, and having been given the rudder in charge, he steers the common vessel of humankind to safety, rejoicing and delighting in nothing more than in doing good to his subjects. For different people owe different contributions, which private citizens are obliged to pay in their cities. But the contribution most proper to a ruler is this: to propose good counsels concerning his subjects, to carry out rightly what has been resolved, and to bring forth good things ungrudgingly with a generous hand and a generous mind. Except for whatever it is right to hold in reserve as a precaution against the uncertainty of the future. With words like these, the unfortunate man kept chanting his charms in hopes of improving Gaius. But Gaius, being fond of strife and contention, turned his mind to the opposite course, as though he had been urged toward it, and grew bold enough to shame his corrector to his face. And sometimes, when he saw him arriving from a distance, he would say the following to those nearby. Here comes the teacher of a man who no longer needs to learn, the tutor of one who is no longer a boy, the counselor of one wiser than himself. The man who thinks the emperor should obey his subject enrolls himself as an expert in the science of rule and as my instructor, though from whom he learned the art of governing, I for my part do not know. For I, from my very swaddling clothes, have had countless teachers, fathers, brothers, uncles, cousins, grandfathers, ancestors going back to the founders of our line, all of them my blood relations on both sides, paternal and maternal, who acquired sovereign power for themselves. Not to mention that even in the first depositing of the seed, there are certain royal potencies belonging to rulers. For just as resemblances of body and soul, in form, in disposition, in movements, in counsels and actions, are preserved in the generative principles, so it is likely that the resemblance to rule itself is sketched out, in still more definite outline within those same principles. Then does someone dare to teach me, who is already fashioned through and through as emperor while still in the womb, in the workshop of nature, an ignorant man instructing a man of knowledge? Where is it lawful for private persons, until just now, even to peer into the counsels of a ruler's soul? Yet with shameless boldness they dare to play the hierophant and to initiate others into the mysteries of rule, though they could scarcely even be enrolled among the initiates themselves. By practicing this little by little, he began to grow estranged from Macro and to fabricate charges against him that were false but plausible and easily believed, for keen and powerful natures are formidable at inventing plausibilities. These were the pretexts. Gaius is my creation, said Macro. I fathered him more than his parents did, or at least no less. Three times over, not once, he would have been snatched away by Tiberius, murderous intent, had it not been for me and my persuasions. And when Tiberius died, holding the military forces under my command, I immediately transferred them over to Gaius, Servus, teaching them that a single man had been lost, while the empire remains sound and complete. Some were persuaded by these words as though they were true, not recognizing the deceitful character of the speaker, for the counterfeit and shifting nature of his character was not yet apparent. But in fact, not many days later, the ill-fated man was put out of the way along with his wife, receiving as recompense for his excessive goodwill the harshest punishment of all. Such is the nature of a favor bestowed on the ungrateful. In return for the benefits they received, they inflict the greatest injuries upon their benefactors. Macro, at any rate, having in truth accomplished everything with the most intense zeal and ambition, first to save Gaius, and then to see that he alone should succeed to the empire, reaped such rewards for his labor. For it is said that the wretched man was compelled to kill himself with his own hand, and his wife suffered the same misfortune, though she had once been thought to have grown genuinely close to him through their long companionship. But they say that nothing bound by love's ties is secure, because of the fickleness of that passion. Now once Macro and his whole household had been sacrificed, Gaius stripped for a third, still graver act of treachery. Marcus Silanus had become his father-in-law, a man full of high spirit and brilliant by birth. When his daughter died an untimely death, Silanus still continued to attend upon Gaius, showing him the goodwill not so much of a father-in-law as of a true father, expecting to receive the same in return, having by the law of equality transformed his son-in-law into a son. But he was deceiving himself, holding a false opinion without realizing it. For Silanus went on continually speaking as a guardian would, concealing nothing of what was needed to improve and benefit Gaius, character, life, and rule, having as grounds for such frankness both his surpassing nobility of birth and his kinship by marriage. Indeed, his daughter had died not so long before that the rightful claims of an in-law should have faded. She was, so to speak, still gasping her last, some final remnants of the vital spirit still remaining and lodged within the body. But Gaius, taking such admonitions as an outrage, because he believed himself the wisest and most self-controlled of all, and moreover the bravest and most just, hated those who instructed him more than he hated his acknowledged enemies. Supposing, then, that this man too was a nuisance who would check the great onrush of his desires, and bidding a hearty farewell to the departed spirits of his dead wife on the grounds that he would remove her father, who had become his father-in-law, he had him treacherously killed. And by now the matter had become notorious, on account of the successive murders of leading men, so that talk of these hard-to-purify pollutions echoed from every mouth, not openly, out of fear, but in a quieter voice. Then, through a change of heart, for the crowd is unsteady in everything, in its counsels, its words, and its deeds, people, disbelieving that Gaius, who a little before had been thought kind and humane, equitable and sociable, had undergone such a sudden and total transformation, began looking for justifications, and searching them out, they found them. Concerning his cousin and co-heir, they said the following: "Rule admits no partner. This is an immovable law of nature. This young man, being stronger, brought about beforehand what he himself was destined to suffer at the hands of a weaker rival. This is self-defense, not murder. Indeed, perhaps it was even a foresighted act, for the benefit of the whole human race, that the boy was removed, since some would have attached themselves to him and others to Gaius, and out of such divisions civil strife and foreign wars arise. And what is better than peace? Peace grows out of right rule, and rule is right only when it is free of rivalry and undivided, through which all else, too, is set right." And concerning Macro, he grew more puffed up than was fitting. He never read the Delphic inscription, "Know yourself." They say that knowledge is the cause of happiness, and ignorance the cause of misery. What had come over him, that he should exchange places and shift the subject into the rank of ruler and the Emperor Gaius into the position of subject? It belongs properly to a ruler to give orders, which is what Macro was doing, and to a subject to obey, which is what he expected Gaius to endure. For these thoughtless people called advice a command, and a counselor a ruler, either failing through obtuseness to understand, or through flattery recasting the true nature of both the words and the things themselves. And concerning Silenus, Silenus suffered something worthy of ridicule, for thinking that a father-in-law could carry as much weight with a son-in-law as a natural father does with a son. And yet fathers, when their sons enter upon great offices and powers, though they are themselves private citizens, hold themselves back, content to take second place. But this foolish man, no longer even a father-in-law, meddled in matters that were none of his concern, not understanding that his kinship by marriage had died along with his daughter's death. For marriage ties are the bond joining unrelated households, drawing what was foreign into kinship. And once that bond is dissolved, the partnership too is dissolved, especially when it is dissolved by an irreparable event, the death of the woman given in marriage into a foreign household. Such things people murmured in every gathering, giving the greatest weight to their wish not to seem to think the emperor cruel. For having hoped that such kindness and humanity as had been established in Gaius, soul, greater than in any of his predecessors, they considered it altogether incredible that he had undergone so great and so sudden a change to the opposite extreme. Having accomplished, then, these three labors just described, drawn from the three most essential quarters, two from within his own country, the senatorial order and the equestrian order, and the third from his own family, and supposing that, having overcome the strongest and most powerful men, he had instilled the most overwhelming fear in everyone else. Through the slaughter of Silenus he had struck fear into the senators, for Silenus had ranked second to none in the Senate. Through the killing of Macro he had struck fear into the equestrians, for Macro had become, so to speak, the leader of their chorus, carrying off the first prizes of honor and renown. And through the murder of his cousin and co-heir, he had struck fear into all his blood relations. He no longer thought it fitting to remain within the bounds of human nature, but overreached himself, striving to be regarded as a god. At the beginning of this madness, they say, he reasoned as follows. Just as the leaders of herds of other animals, cowherds, goatherds, and shepherds, are not themselves cattle or goats or sheep, but human beings who have attained a superior lot and constitution, In the same way I too, since I lead the herd, must be reckoned as set apart from the best herd of the human race, and not to belong to the category of man, but to have obtained a greater and more divine lot. Having sealed this notion in his mind, the fool carried around within himself this mythical fabrication as though it were the most unassailable truth. And once he had grown bold and dared to publish to the multitude this most godless self-deification of himself, he set about doing the things that followed from it and were consonant with it, and, as if by a series of steps, advanced little by little upward. For he began at first by making himself resemble the so-called demigods, Dionysus, Heracles, and the Dioscuri, treating their oracular shrines and rites, Trophonius and Amphiaraus and Amphilochus, and the like, as objects of mockery by comparison with his own power. Then, as in a theater, he would take up now one costume and now another. At one time, the lionskin and club, both gilded, got up as Heracles. At another, a cap set upon his head when he was playing at being one of the Dioscuri. And at still other times, he was decked out with ivy, thyrsus, and fawnskins as Dionysus. And he claimed to surpass even them on this ground, that each of those gods, having his own particular honors, did not lay claim to those shared by the others, whereas he arrogated to himself the honors of all of them together, out of envy and greed. Indeed, he outdid even those gods themselves, not by changing into a three-bodied Geryon, so as to deceive onlookers by sheer number, but, and this was the most extraordinary thing, while remaining a single body, transforming and recasting himself into manifold shapes. After the fashion of the Egyptian Proteus, whom Homer represented as undergoing every sort of change into the elements and the animals and plants that arise from them. And yet, Gaius, what need had you of these emblems, you who were accustomed to have set up statues of the very beings just named? For what was needed was to emulate their virtues. Heracles purged land and sea, undertaking the most necessary and beneficial labors for the sake of all humankind, in order to destroy the harmful and destructive elements in the nature of each. Dionysus tamed the vine, and pouring out from it a drink at once most pleasant and most beneficial to souls and bodies alike, brings souls to good cheer, working in them forgetfulness of evils and hopes of good things, while he renders bodies healthier, stronger, and more agile. And he makes each individual human being better, and transforms populous households and kinship groups from a parched and toilsome existence into the pattern of a relaxed and cheerful way of life, and furnishes to every city, Greek and barbarian alike, feastings, merriments, festivities, and festivals one after another. For unmixed wine is the cause of all that has been mentioned. Again, tradition holds that the Dioscuri shared their immortality in common. For since one of them was mortal and the other immortal, the one who had been granted the better lot did not think it right to love himself more than to show goodwill toward his brother. For having envisioned the endless span of time and reckoned that he himself would live forever while his brother would be forever dead, and that along with his immortality he would take on an immortal grief for his brother, he brought about a marvelous exchange, blending together for himself what was mortal and for his brother what was imperishable, and did away with inequality, the source of injustice, by means of equality, which is the wellspring of justice. All these, Gaius, were admired because of the benefactions they had performed, and are admired even now, and were deemed worthy of reverence and the highest honors. Tell us, then, yourself, on what ground do you swell with pride and puff yourself up as their equal? Did you imitate the Dioscuri in brotherly love? Let me begin from this point. Your own brother and co-heir in the prime of his early manhood, you man of iron, most pitiless of men, you slaughtered savagely, and your sisters you later drove into exile. Did they too instill in you a fear that they might take away your rule? Did you imitate Dionysus? Have you become a discoverer of new graces, as he was? Have you filled the inhabited world with good cheer? Do Asia and Europe find themselves unable to contain the gifts that have come from you? Rather, as a common blight and avenging fury, you have discovered new arts and sciences by which you turn pleasant and joyful things into unpleasantness, grief, and an unlivable life for all people everywhere, seizing for yourself, with insatiable and unquenchable desires, all the good and beautiful things possessed by others. Those from the eastern lands, those from the western, those from all the other regions of the whole world, whatever there was to the south or toward the north. while in return you give back and send out, from your own bitterness, all the harmful and ruinous things that accursed and venomous souls are wont to breed. Is it for this that you have appeared to us as the new Dionysus? But you also emulated Heracles, did you, with your untiring labors and unwearied feats of manly courage? Good order and just law, abundance and prosperity, and a plenty of all other good things, of which deep peace is the craftsman, filling continents and islands with these, you, the basest of the base, full of cowardice, you who have emptied the cities of everything conducive to stability and happiness, and have filled them instead with things productive of turmoil and confusion and the utmost misery. In the face of such great calamities as you have brought upon us for our ruin, tell me, Gaius, do you seek to obtain a share of immortality, so that you may render your disasters not brief and short-lived but everlasting? I think, on the contrary, that even if you were once thought to have become a god, you would surely, on account of your wicked practices, be changed back into a mortal nature. For if virtues confer immortality, vices surely bring corruption. So do not enroll yourself among the Dioscuri, those most devoted of brothers, you who have become the slayer and destroyer of your own brothers, nor lay claim to a share of the honor of Heracles or Dionysus, benefactors of human life, you who are a ruiner and corrupter of the very things they achieved. So great was the frenzy that possessed him, and such the deranged and distracted madness, that he passed even beyond the demigods and pressed on, stripping for a contest with the reverence paid to beings reputed greater and more fully divine, Hermes, Apollo, and Ares. Hermes first. Arraying himself in herald's staff, sandals, and cloak, he made a show of order amid disorder, of consistency amid confusion, and of reason amid derangement. Then, whenever it took his fancy, he would set these aside and transform and re-equip himself into Apollo, binding his head with rayed crowns, holding a bow in his left hand and arrows, and extending graces with his right. As though it were fitting to offer good things readily, with the better position, the right, assigned to that purpose, while punishments were to be withheld and assigned the inferior position. That is, the left. And choruses at once stood arrayed, singing paeans to him, the very same who a little before had been calling him Bacchus, Euios, and Laius, and honoring him with hymns when he took up the trappings of Dionysus. Often, too, putting on a breastplate and sword, he would go forth with helmet and shield, invoked as Ares, and on either side of him marched the attendants of this new and young Ares, a company of murderers and public executioners, ready to render base services to one who lusted for blood and thirsted for human gore. Then those who witnessed these things were struck with amazement at the absurdity, and marveled how a man who does the very opposite of what those he chooses to rival do should not think it worth his while to practice their virtues, yet gets himself up in the emblems proper to each of them. And yet these appended ornaments and adornments are set upon carved images and statues as symbols signifying the benefits that those so honored provide to the human race. Hermes wears sandals fitted with the pinions of wings on their soles. Why? Is it not because it is fitting that the interpreter and prophet of things divine, from which very function he has been named Hermes, in announcing good things, for no one who brings news of evil can be a spokesman, not even for a wise man, let alone a god, should be swiftest of foot and all but borne on wings, owing to his unhesitating eagerness. For it is fitting to be first to bring good news of what is advantageous, just as one ought to delay in reporting what is ill-omened, if one is permitted to let it rest in silence. Again, he takes up the herald's staff, a token of treaties of reconciliation. For wars secure truces and settlements through heralds who establish peace, while wars without heralds produce endless calamities both for those who wage them and for those who defend against them. But for what purpose did Gaius take up the sandals? Was it so that ill-omened and inauspicious things, which ought to be kept quiet, might be proclaimed everywhere with headlong speed, resounding on every side? And yet what need was there for such hurried movement? For even standing still, he poured out countless evils upon evils, as if from ever-flowing springs, raining them down on every part of the inhabited world. What need has he of a herald's staff, who never once spoke or did anything peaceable, but filled every household and city with civil wars throughout both Greece and the barbarian world? Let him set aside Hermes, then, let him renounce this name that does not belong to him, this false name? What is there in him resembling Apollo's offspring? He wears a crown of rays, the craftsman having skillfully imitated the sun's beams. But to that god, the sun, or light altogether, is welcome, not night, nor darkness, nor whatever is more lightless than darkness and fit for the state of his lawless deeds. For fine things need the full brightness of midday to be displayed, but shameful things, they say, need the depths of Tartarus, into which they deserve to be thrust, so as to be properly hidden. Let him also change what is in each hand, and not falsify their order. Let him hold out arrows and a bow in his right hand, for he knows how to shoot arrows and hit his mark against men, women, whole families, and flourishing cities, for their utter destruction. As for the graces, let him either fling them away quickly or hide them in his left hand, for their beauty put them to shame, since he was forever leering and gaping after great fortunes, lusting for unjust plunder, by which their owners were butchered for the sake of a prosperity that brought them only misfortune. But he also thoroughly falsified the medical art of Apollo. For Apollo became the discoverer of healing remedies for the health of mankind, claiming even to cure the diseases brought on by others, because of the surpassing gentleness that came to him both by nature and by practice. Gaius, by contrast, brought diseases upon the healthy, mutilation upon the whole, and, in short, deaths inflicted by human hands upon the living, harsh deaths ahead of their appointed time, having prepared every instrument of destruction in unstinting supply. And if he had not been cut off first by justice, he would soon have destroyed whatever was most esteemed in every city. For his preparations were ready above all against those in office, and the wealthy, especially those in Rome and the rest of Italy, among whom silver and gold were stored up in such quantity that, if all the rest of the inhabited world's wealth were gathered together from its farthest reaches, it would be found far inferior. For this reason it was from his own homeland, as if from a sacred place, that he began to scatter the seeds of war in place of peace. He, the city hater, the people devourer, the plague, the destroying evil. Apollo is said to be not only a healer, but also a good prophet, foretelling the future through oracles for the benefit of mankind, so that no one, overshadowed by ignorance of what is hidden, might stumble blindly and unforeseeing into what is undesirable as though it were most profitable. But rather, having learned the future beforehand as though it were already present, and seeing it with the mind no less than what is at hand is guarded against by the eyes of the body, he might take precaution against suffering anything irreparable. Is it, then, worth setting against these the ill-omened oracles of Gaius, through which poverty, dishonor, exile, and death were foretold everywhere for those in office and in power? What partnership, then, is there with Apollo for one who has practiced nothing proper or akin to him? Let the false-named healer cease imitating the true healer, for just as with counterfeit coin, a false stamp does not make the form of a god. One might sooner hope for anything at all than that such a body and such a soul, both soft, could ever be made to resemble the strength of Ares in either respect. But he, like an actor on a stage changing many masks, deceived onlookers with false appearances. Come, then, let none of the matters of body or soul be examined further, given his estrangement in every disposition and movement from the divinity just mentioned. As for the power of Ares, not the mythologized Ares, but the reason that exists in nature, to which courage has been allotted. Do we not know it to be a power that wards off evil, a helper, and a defender of those who are wronged, as indeed the very name seems to show? For it seems to me that Ares was named in our tongue from Erigene, which means to help, one who puts down wars, a craftsman of peace. Of that peace Gaius was an enemy, but a comrade of wars, turning stability into turmoil and faction. Have we not now learned from all this that Gaius ought not to be likened to any god, nor even to any demigod, since he had attained neither their nature, nor their essence, nor even their moral purpose? Desire, it seems, is blind, and most of all when it takes on vainglory together with love of strife, joined to the greatest power, the very power under which we, who were formerly prosperous, were ruined. For he eyed the Jews alone with suspicion, as though they alone had chosen the opposite course and had been taught, in a manner, from their very swaddling clothes by parents, tutors, and instructors, and long before that by the sacred laws, and further still by unwritten customs, to regard as one the father and maker of the world, God. For all the others, men, women, cities, nations, regions, climates of the earth, almost the whole inhabited world, I might say, although groaning at what was happening, nonetheless flattered him no less, exalting him beyond measure and swelling his conceit still further. Some even brought the barbarian custom into Italy, prostration, falsifying the noble character of Roman freedom. One nation alone, that of the Jews, was singled out as suspected of resistance, being accustomed to welcome voluntary deaths as though they were immortality, so as not to overlook the destruction of any of their ancestral ways, however small. Because, just as with buildings, the removal of a single stone makes even what still seems to stand firmly collapse, giving way and crumbling toward the empty space. And what was being shaken was no small thing, but the greatest of all realities. That man's begotten and perishable nature should be turned into the unbegotten, and whatever else seemed to have fashioned itself into a god, which he judged to be the most grievous of impieties, for it would be quicker for a god to change into a man than a man into a god. Apart from also taking on all the other highest vices, distrust together with ingratitude toward the benefactor of the whole world, who by his own power grants unstinting abundance of good things to every part of the universe. So the greatest and undeclared war was being mounted against the nation. For what heavier evil could there be for a slave than a hostile master? And the subjects were slaves of the emperor, even if unlike any other previous emperor in this respect, because those before ruled with fairness and according to law. But Gaius had cut off all gentleness from his soul and set his heart on lawlessness. For, considering himself the law, he treated the laws of lawgivers everywhere as empty words and set them aside. And we were registered not merely among slaves, but among the most dishonored of slaves, since the ruler was turning into a master. Perceiving this, the mixed and disorderly mob of Alexandria attacked us, supposing that the most opportune moment had presented itself and brought to light the hatred that had long been smoldering, stirring, and throwing everything into confusion. For, treating us as though we had been handed over by the emperor to acknowledged and utter disaster, or as though we had been conquered in war, they set upon us with frenzied and utterly savage rage, rushing into our houses and driving the owners out along with their wives and children, so as to leave them empty of inhabitants. Furniture and valuables they no longer stole like thieves, watching for night and darkness for fear of capture, but carried off openly in broad daylight, displaying them to passers-by, as though they were heirs or purchasers acting on behalf of the owners. And if several of them agreed to act together in the plunder, they divided the spoil in the middle of the marketplace, often before the very eyes of the owners, mocking and jeering at them. These things, then, were terrible enough in themselves. How could they not be? To become poor from rich and destitute from prosperous, though guilty of no wrong, suddenly homeless and without hearth, driven out and exiled from their own houses, so that, remaining in the open day and night, they might perish either from the scorching of the sun or the chill of the nights. But these were lighter matters compared to what is about to be told. For having herded so many tens of thousands of men, women, and children together like cattle and livestock from the whole city into the smallest possible quarter, as though into some pen, they expected within a few days to find heaps of corpses piled together, either destroyed by hunger for lack of necessities, since the necessary supplies had not been prepared in advance, as if in prophecy of the sudden catastrophe, or through crushing and suffocation, since no open space was afforded. And the surrounding air itself was corrupted, along with whatever vital element it contained for breathing, or, to speak the truth, was infected by the very gasps of those breathing their last, by which, inflamed and in a sense pressed down by the onset of fever, they drew in through nostrils and mouth a hot and unnatural breath, bringing, as the proverb says, fire upon fire. The organs inside the body are by nature the most fiery of all. When the breezes from outside blow moderately cool, the instruments of breathing proceed smoothly, thanks to the good mixture of the air. But when the air turns hotter, the passages must inevitably become obstructed, as fire flows in upon fire. No longer able to endure the cramped confines, they poured themselves out into deserted places, beaches, and tombs, craving to draw in pure and harmless air. But those who had already been trapped in other parts of the city, or who came in from the countryside unaware of the disasters that had broken out, suffered calamities of every kind. Some were stoned, some wounded by roof tiles, others had the most vital parts of their bodies, and especially their heads, beaten to death with clubs of holm oak and oak. Meanwhile, some of those who habitually have nothing to do and plenty of leisure sat in a circle watching the small remnant who had been driven and herded together into this remote corner, as I said, guarding them like men under siege, in case any should slip out unnoticed. And indeed, not a few, disregarding their own safety for lack of necessities, were bound to come out for fear that their whole households would perish of starvation. Watching for the moment these people broke ranks, the guards kept a lookout, and any they seized they destroyed at once, torturing them with every kind of outrage. There was yet another company lying in wait at the river harbors to plunder the Jews coming down from their boats and whatever goods they were bringing in for trade. Boarding the vessels, they carried off the cargo before the very eyes of its owners, and then, twisting the owners' arms behind them, set them on fire, using for fuel the rudders, tillers, poles, and the planks of the decks. For those who were burned in the middle of the city, the death was most pitiful of all. For lack of wood, they sometimes gathered brushwood, and having kindled it, threw it upon the wretched victims. These, half-burned, were destroyed more by the smoke than by the fire, since the brushwood kindled only a feeble, smoky flame that went out at once, being too light to turn to glowing coals. Many who were still alive they bound with straps and nooses, tightened around the ankles, and dragged them through the middle of the marketplace, leaping upon them, and they did not even spare the bodies of the dead. Tearing them apart limb by limb and trampling them, these men, more savage and brutal than untamed beasts, consumed every last shred, so that not even a remnant was left that could obtain the honor of burial. The governor of the region, the one man who by his own will could have put down mob rule in a single hour, pretended not to see what he saw and not to hear what he heard, but instead gave free rein to warmongering and threw peace into confusion. And so the mob, further incited, rushed into shameless and even bolder schemes. Banding together in enormous crowds, they attacked the synagogues. There are many in each district of the city. Some they stripped of their wooden fittings, others they razed to their very foundations, and into others they threw fire and burned them down, in their frenzy and insane madness giving no thought even to the neighboring houses, for nothing moves faster than fire once it has taken hold of an entire building. And I pass over in silence the honors of the emperors, the shields, the gilded crowns, the inscribed slabs and inscriptions that were pulled down and burned along with the synagogues, honors which they were obligated to preserve even above all else. But they were emboldened because they had no fear of retribution from Gaius, whom they knew well to bear an unspeakable hatred toward the Jews, so much so that they suspected no one could do anything more pleasing to him than to heap every kind of evil upon the nation. Wishing to worm their way into his favor with novel flatteries and to indulge, with total impunity, their outrages against us, what do they do? As for those synagogues they had not been able to obliterate by fire and demolition, because so many Jews lived clustered nearby, they ravaged them in a different way, one that overturned our laws and customs. For they set up images of Gaius in every one of them, and in the largest and most conspicuous, a bronze statue of him mounted on a four-horse chariot. And such was the speed and the intensity of their zeal that, having no new charioteer for ready to hand, they brought one from the gymnasium, a very old one, worn out, its ears, tails, hooves, and a few other parts broken off, which some say had even been dedicated in honor of a woman, the elder Cleopatra, who was the great-grandmother of the last Cleopatra. How great an accusation this in itself brought upon those who set it up is obvious to everyone. For what does it matter if it belonged to a woman? What does it matter if it was old and belonged to a man? What does it matter if, in general, it had been dedicated in someone else's name? Men who set up such a thing in honor of the emperor could hardly be expected to take care that no report of it should reach one who, above all others, makes everything about himself an object of solemn reverence. But they, on the strength of their overwhelming confidence, expected to be praised and to enjoy still greater and more splendid benefits, for having dedicated to Gaius new precincts by converting the synagogues, not for the sake of honoring him, but so that they might glut themselves in every way with acts of malice against our nation. Clear proofs of this can be found. First, from the kings. In the course of roughly 10 or even more kings in succession over 300 years, they set up not a single image or statue in the synagogues, even though these kings were their own kin and relatives, whom they regarded, wrote of, and addressed as gods. And why should they not have done so, being merely human, they who deified dogs, wolves, lions, crocodiles, and a great many other beasts, aquatic and terrestrial, and birds as well, for whom altars, shrines, temples, and precincts are established throughout all Egypt? Perhaps they will now say, though they would not have said it then, since people are accustomed to court the good fortune of their rulers rather than the rulers themselves, that the emperors hold a higher rank and station than the Ptolemies, and are therefore owed still greater honors. Then, O most foolish of all people, to avoid being forced to say anything more blasphemous, why did you not consider Tiberius, who came before Gaius and was even responsible for his succession to power, worthy of the same honor? For 23 years he held sway over land and sea, and did not allow even a seed of war to smolder either in Greece or among the barbarian nations, but provided peace and the blessings of peace, to the very end of his life, with a generous and open hand and mind. Was his lineage inferior? No, he was of the noblest birth on both his parents' sides. Was it his education? And who among the men who flourished in his time was wiser or more eloquent than he? Was it his age? And what king or emperor grew old more gracefully? Indeed, even while still young, he was called an old man on account of the reverence people felt for his shrewdness. Was it he, then, a man so great and so distinguished, whom you overlooked and passed by? What of the other? He who surpassed human nature in every virtue, who because of the greatness of his sole rule together with his nobility of character, was the first to be named Augustus, receiving that title not as a portion of an inheritance passed down through his family line, but by himself becoming the beginning of reverence even for those who came after him. He who, when he first came forward to take charge of public affairs, found them in turmoil and confusion. For islands were contending against continents, and continents against islands, over primacy, each having as their leaders and champions the most eminent men of Rome in office. And again, the great regions of the inhabited world, Asia against Europe and Europe against Asia, were vying for supreme power. The nations of Europe and Asia having risen up from the ends of the earth, and waging grievous wars against one another over the whole of land and sea, in battles by infantry and by fleet, so that the entire human race came close to being consumed in mutual slaughter and utterly annihilated, had it not been for one man and leader, Augustus, whom it is fitting to call the averter of evil. This is the Caesar who calmed the storms crashing down on every side, who healed the diseases common to Greeks and barbarians alike, diseases that came down from the regions of the south and the east and ran their course all the way to the west and the north, sowing their unwanted seed across the borderlands and the seas between. This is the man who loosed the chains that had bound and crushed the inhabited world, not merely slackening them. This is the man who destroyed both the open and the hidden wars caused by the raids of brigands. This is the man who cleared the sea of pirate vessels and filled it instead with merchant ships. This is the one who set free every city that had lost its liberty, who brought disorder into order, who tamed and reconciled every savage and beast-like nation, who enlarged Greece with many new Greek cities, and who, in the most essential regions of the barbarian world, made it Greek as well. The guardian of peace, the distributor to each of what falls to them, the one who laid his benefits out in the open without holding any in reserve, who concealed no good or noble thing throughout the whole of his life. Yet this man, so great a benefactor, they concealed from view in the synagogues for the 43 years during which he ruled Egypt, setting up nothing on his behalf, no image, no carved statue, no painting. And indeed, if new and exceptional honors needed to be voted for anyone, it was fitting that they should go to him, not only because he was in some sense the origin and source of the line of Augustus, nor only because he was the first, the greatest, and the common benefactor, who in place of a multiplicity of rulers entrusted the steering of the common vessel to a single pilot himself, being wondrously skilled in the art of governing, for it has rightly been said that the rule of many is not good. since a multiplicity of authorities is the cause of manifold evils, but also because the whole inhabited world voted him honors equal to those of Olympian gods. And temples, gateways, sacred precincts, and colonnades bear witness to this, so that whatever magnificent works the cities, whether new or old, possess are surpassed in beauty and grandeur by the Caesarea. And this is especially so in our own Alexandria. Indeed, no precinct is like the one called the Sebastian, the temple of Caesar who first set foot here, which opposite the safest harbors rises high, greatest, and most conspicuous, and is filled as nowhere else with dedications, encircled with paintings and statues and silver and gold, a precinct of the widest extent, with porticos, libraries, banquet halls, groves, gateways, open spaces, courts open to the sky, adorned with everything fashioned for the most lavish splendor. A saving hope for those setting sail and those returning to harbor. Having then such grounds, and all people everywhere of one mind with us, did we introduce any innovation regarding our houses of prayer, or fail to preserve each observance? Or did we omit any honor owed to Caesar? Who in his right mind could say so? Why then were we deprived? I will say, holding nothing back. They knew of his diligence, and that he made as much account of confirming the ancestral customs of each people as he did those of the Romans, and that he accepted the honors given him not for the overthrow of the established laws among some who fashion themselves as gods, but as one following the greatness of so vast an empire, which by nature comes to be made solemn through such things. The clearest proof that he was never bound and puffed up by excessive honors is that he never once wished to be addressed as God. And though someone might say this was distasteful to him, that he welcomed the Jews, whom he knew precisely to hold all such things in abhorrence as impious. How then did he approve of the great section of Rome across the Tiber, which he well knew was held and inhabited by Jews? Most of these were Romans who had been freed. Brought as captives into Italy, they were set free by those who had owned them, without being compelled to alter any of their ancestral customs. He knew, then, that they had houses of prayer and gathered in them, especially on the sacred 7th days, when they are publicly instructed in their ancestral philosophy. He knew, too, that they collected money from the first fruits and sent it to Jerusalem by the hands of those who would conduct the sacrifices. Yet all the same, he neither expelled them from Rome nor took away their Roman citizenship, because they were also mindful of their Jewish one. Nor did he innovate against their houses of prayer, nor did he forbid their gathering for instruction in the laws, nor did he oppose those who offered first fruits. Rather, he was so reverent toward what is ours that he adorned our temple with the costliest of dedications, all but from his whole household, and ordered that perpetual sacrifices of whole burnt offerings be brought continually every day, at his own expense, as a first fruit to the most high God, sacrifices which are performed even now and will be performed forever, a token of truly imperial character. Moreover, even in the monthly distributions made to the people, when the whole populace received in turn either money or grain, he never once deprived the Jews of that favor. But if it happened that the distribution fell on the sacred 7th day, when it is forbidden to receive or to give or in general to transact any business of livelihood, and especially any that involves earning, he had ordered those in charge of the distributions to reserve for the Jews until the following day the common benefaction. For this reason, all people everywhere, even if by nature they were not favorably disposed toward the Jews, were cautious about laying a hand on any of the Jewish customs to overthrow it. And this held true in the same way even under Tiberius, though there had been disturbances stirred up in Italy at the time when Sejanus was contriving his attack. For he knew at once, right after that man's death, that the accusations brought against the Jews who inhabited Rome were false slanders, fabrications of Sejanus, who wished to destroy the nation, which he knew would, alone or above all others, resist his unholy designs and actions, in order to prevent the emperor from being betrayed and endangered. And he instructed the governors appointed everywhere to reassure the members of the nation in each city, since the prosecution had not extended to all but only to the guilty, and these were few, and to disturb none of their customary practices, but to hold in trust both the men themselves, as peaceable by nature, and their laws, as tending toward stability. But Gaius, utterly puffed up with vanity, not merely said but actually believed himself to be a god. Then he found no people, whether Greek or barbarian, more suited than the Alexandrians to confirm his boundless desire, one beyond human nature. For they are clever at flattery and deception and pretense, having prepared fawning speeches, and defiling everything with unrestrained and unbridled mouths. The title God is used among them so loosely that they have granted it even to ibises and to the venomous native asps and to many other of the savage beasts among them. So that, naturally, by using without restraint names that properly belong to God, they deceive the foolish and those unacquainted with Egyptian godlessness, while they are caught out by those who know the great folly, or rather impiety, of these people. Gaius, being unacquainted with this, actually supposed that he was truly regarded as a god by the Alexandrians, since they used, not obliquely but directly and to excess, all the names that others are accustomed to attribute to gods. Furthermore, he supposed that the innovation concerning the houses of prayer had arisen from a pure conscience freely given and from unmixed honor toward himself, partly through attending to the memorandum diaries that certain persons kept sending from Alexandria. For this was his most delightful reading, so much so that, compared with the charm found in these, the writings of other authors and poets were reckoned most unpleasant. And partly through certain household servants who were forever mocking and jeering along with him. Most of these were Egyptians, an evil breed, who had mixed into their souls the venom and rage of the native crocodiles and asps together. And leader of this whole chorus of the Egyptian troop was a certain Helicon, an accursed and utterly execrable slave who had wormed his way into the imperial household. For he had tasted a smattering of general education, thanks to the ambition of his former master, who had presented him as a gift to Tiberius Caesar. At that time, then, he enjoyed no special favor, since Tiberius detested such juvenile pleasantries, being inclined almost from his earliest years toward the more solemn and austere. But when Tiberius died and Gaius succeeded to the rule, a young master given over through every sense to relaxation and luxury, Helicon said to himself, "Now, Helicon, is your moment, rouse yourself. You have as your audience and spectator, for the display of your talents, the best of all men."